sun being followed by a moon shadow. Moon shadow, moon shadow, leaping and hopping on a moon shadow. Moon shadow, moon shadow. And if I ever lose my legs, I won't moan and I won't beg. Oh, if I ever lose my legs, oh, if I won't have to walk no more. And if I ever lose my mouth, all my teeth, north and south. Yes, if I ever lose my mouth, oh, I won't have to talk.
The hunter ventured still to hunt, but found more in discovery than he did in fare to eat. Varmints were to be had, many ground squirrels, occasional fox, sometimes grouse. He discovered enormous sea lion colonies populating rocks offshore, but these could not be reached. Their canoes were unfit for the sea and capsized on the surf in the several attempts. These offshore rocks, salt-rimed, weirdly distorted colossus, would be castles in the sea, carved by savage surf, sometimes shaped to insurmountable towers, sometimes penetrated through which archways the surf lashed. The lay of these rocks was strangely approached by unlikely bridges of beach, strands only reached from the coast when the tides drew out the sea. Beyond them, at the shore, above these crescent beaches of fine white sand, such Gothic cliffs loomed of rock similarly disfigured. The same eaten substance of those sea-bound rock isles, which he imagined like monstrous creatures in a tragic escape, giants of the coast, had tried to break away from their stone imprisonment in certain mythic times, and had wearily strode on heavy stone legs into the sea, but there had been paralyzed by the sea water, risen to their waist or their knees, and there were frozen and doomed to be gradually eaten away. The fine white sands of the beach must be the atoms of their bones. Walking along these beaches, the hunter and the dog encountered crabs and starfish and mollusks of many kinds, clams revealed by the apertures in the white sand, which made for breathing. These provided a new and delicious food for the both of them. They began to live apart from the core. The ocean compelled the hunter in the same manner as had the mountains. The ocean's plenty comforted him. The ocean's surf, the resounding rhythm of it, emptied him of his thoughts. It was as if the sound of the ocean replaced his mind. He found abundant driftwood easily with which to build fires. He tented in a hidden place that the ocean had long ago carved and abandoned, shielded from the winds that sometimes thrash so severely that with the sea spray they stung and made him raw. In this alcove he created a hideaway, remote and private and unknown to the others, and he only visited the others when he had collected seafood that he might share with them. Throughout the winter, the hunter returned to the fort occasionally with his dog, bearing a pack sack full of seafood. Whenever he did, he was always greeted eagerly by hungry men, wanting the diversity of the diet that he provided, and enjoying the other delights that he occasionally brought, tales of what he had found, and so on. Otherwise, he lived alone with his dog by the sea. One day, in the early spring of the new year, there was a violent storm which swept from the sea and flooded the land. driven into his alcove by the gales and rain, he saw the ocean surge and was forced to save his camp, to climb into a cavernous nook in the rocks, and without a fire, to wait for days for it to subside. When it ended over one night, and the stars were fully and richly displayed, he still could not get down to the beach until the morning of the next day, when the full moon, with the aid of the tide, drew the sea away from his alcove and made it possible to regain his dwelling place. He stepped into a world then transfigured by the storm. The wrack of it was everywhere. It included much that he might eat, but also heaps of brown kelp, their bladders swelling in the sun. The sun shone high and merrily upon the day, the sky as blue as paint, cloudless and warm. You would not know a storm had happened except by the wreckage here washed and spread about, everything cleansed by destruction. With the sun warmly overhead, my dog beside me, the surf softly plays. I loaf for an hour on my back on the sands. As I lie, my head on my crossed arms, I watch the seagulls. To my left, a bank of several thousand brilliant, small, identical shells, wave-washed, shivered by the wash that toys with them. A clattering carpet of sparkling miniatures, conches. Pink as peaches outside, spiral-ribbed, with little nubs along the rib. Gathering up a handful of these shells, I stood and examined them. Mostly very small, but so perfect in their helix. And at the lips of a secret which inwardly turns, containing their lost self, a rosy blush and porcelain and opalescence in their vesicular mouths where, curling inwardly, vulnerable, where there is an emptiness held in a fetal-like embrace. This emptiness that remembers the vacant semblance of the sea, the life lost, passed while in the sea. I looked up to watch the breakers beat, heaving in series along the infinite shore of this internal sea, splendid in the sun. Then in a meditation I saw how regularly varied the colors of the repeating waves as they folded and unfolded, rising translucent as glass, then darkened with density and collected mass, breaking across in shimmering light, and I recognized how also variously different is the form of each curved and blossoming crest as it appeared, though born in the same common substance, each arising solitarily, each unique, like me, solitary and breaking free, cast and yet connected to the sea, attached and sustained and made to be, tumbling on its own momentum yet borne forward by the mass of the whole sea, the sea within it and behind it. The breakers carry richly varied songs, each their own. What we call the roar is the throat of each expiring upon the shore. I compared their variation with the distances to which the broken wave reached, the height of them as each broke, the fall of them as each flung their foamy wreath of fading water upon the shore, and heard how distinct they each were, and yet how much in unison they sing. How one great shared song of each instant voice, incessant and present, breaking white on shores that span beaches of the globe, is a simultaneous moment of all waves, all the oceans shared, in unison of all alive, in the moment we share. I put the seashells in my pocket and walked the beach and traveled out of the strands exposed to distant rock isles toward the sea. At other times inaccessible to me, feeling the shells in my pants pockets with my fingers rolling them among my fingers like money. I saw waves leaping from the deep and advance the beveled strand to bloom and die in a mass of white beside a rock isle along its lee side in the sun, where the wash spreads as it lingers like linen tattered tablecloth flung out to lie, but melting, merging into the wet sands and dropping swirls into pockets of rocks like milk foam in teacups, spinning and dissolving. I chased down the spent waters as the wave returned to the deep, wading into their spangled decay until chased back by returning wave and up the embankment of the isle. Thus playing, half seriously seeking, I discovered in a roiling tub of sea waves, couched in the rock wall, a wavering little plant with sunlit open flower, alone, submerged, cringing, clinging to a ragged cusp at the bottom where nothing else could hold itself in that wave-washed pool, swaying in that chanting wave. The flower was a white star within which a smaller yellow star was centered and clasped by a green calyx, and this all evidently fixed by invisible element to the rock. I stooped over it for a moment before the oncoming of another wave and asked it, "Why are you here?" And I looked up to see whether on the rock isle there was a natal home for it, but the rock isle was desolate and bare. I looked back at it again and declared, "You can't be living here." But stepping down into the pool, though it rose with each wave to my chest as it receded to my knees, I saw the little flower was, after all, truly and heartily rooted and alive. "How is this possible?" I asked. The following day, the hunter visited the fort with his dog, bringing his usual sack of seafood, on this occasion a feast of crabs which he had collected from the sea wrack of the violent storm, having been washed up in myriads and stranded unnaturally along the shore by masses of deep upwelling waves. The men heaped the live, scrabbling crabs tumbling out of the sack onto the muddy ground and swiftly mounted a fire and set a kettle of water to bring to a boil. The captain informed him then of the imminent departure of the corps. The hunter replied he would tarry at the coast and join them in a while. The captain told him that he should not stay, but must join them when they leave. The hunter said nothing then, but the captain watched him the duration of his day among them, and when evening began and he was about to leave, the captain stopped him and told him he should leave the dog behind. The hunter looked at his dog, spoke a few words, and the dog remained as he left. Returning to the sea alone, wandering in errant grief, the hunter found a beached whale on a strand, dying as it lay out of its element. The tide, so distant because of syzygy and languishing because the engorged, inflamed full moon upon the horizon, now heartlessly withheld the sea's return, heartless for this abandoned child, and would not let her daughter tides to return to embrace the dying whale, to draw it back to her bosom. So the hunter squatted on his haunches and spoke to it, its large, ancient eye upon him, calmly responding to his own quiet words. His communion with the whale continued for several hours, until the eye became dull with death, the film of non-existence passing between them. And then the hunter left, upon or near midnight, to find his alcove and there to sleep. The following day he found the whale was now already the food of many predators of many kinds. From land, the sea, the air, nothing would omit the feast of it. And he went by its corpse without stopping. Approaching the fort, he found the corps was packing. The captain greeted him with his gun upon him, asked him why he had not brought his gear. The hunter asked for his dog. And the captain said they had eaten the dog, and that the hunter should return at once with his gear. The hunter turned away, and he did not come back to them, but waited at his tent, slept, or foraged, and waited several days until he was certain they had departed. He returned then to the fort, found it abandoned, found some items of utility, and then left it, never to see it or the corps again. When several days later he decided to leave the sea and return to the east, he passed the whale, which was now skeletal, decaying flesh of it hanging in shreds of its bones, partly washed among the waves that had at last embraced it. He acknowledged it solemnly before he returned to climb the cliffs. Then, taking the southern shore of the Columbia River, which he knew was not the route taken by the corps, directed himself toward the Rocky Mountains, where he hoped he might engage the Shoshone and negotiate for a horse. At a village of the Clackamas Nation, on the flats along the Columbia where it meets the Multnomah River, he traded away the captain's espadon for a dugout canoe and paddles. The Clackamas believes they had gotten the better bargain, but the canoe served the hunter effectively for the long journey up the Columbia and down the South Fork of the Lewis River, where he should hope to meet with Shoshone. The corps had taken the Northern Fork, he believed, as the more direct route to the Missouri. He would avoid the Missouri and find a southern trek. The Southern Fork, he knew, might bring encounter with the Blackfoot, as it originated in high plains where they hunted buffalo. But this, he guessed, would be better than meeting the corps, where he should be certainly tried for desertion, and certainly shot or hung in summary execution. If the Blackfoot reviled him, it was at least without hypocrisy, and if they killed him, it would be without judgment. Upon the headwaters of the Southern Fork, after many a false and difficult trial, but aiming to follow watercourses which directly wandered from the mountains, he found a tributary in which he abandoned his canoe as impassable and too arduous to portage further, for there was no open water, but only cascades at a certain point. Along this stream, hiking, carrying less and less as he consumed or lost what he carried, he reached at last a southern pass, a narrows between mountains, where he perceived the rivers on the other side should flow away from him, northerly and easterly, and thence join the Missouri, or possibly the Arkansas. Where then he could turn and bear to the south and the east. He found high and arid plains, plains of withered sage and little else. Again, the prickly pear often carpeted it widely and was blossoming profusely in spite of, or perhaps because of, the lack of any rainfall. The land was serpentine with narrows and slope-backed ridges, mottled and striated in oranges, reds, and yellows, and ran in puzzled paths, where the flash floods smoothed the flats or creased the folds. The soil on the basins that sometimes widened between them was almost chalky in places, and so alkaline that it ate up the soles of his moccasins like lye would do. The holes in them showed to be eaten as if sucked by acid mouths, leaving holes with white lips. He bound his feet with other buckskin that he wore, and could do without, but soon these were destroyed. He went mostly barefoot, and counted himself mostly fortunate to toughen his feet. His feet became like the tanned hide of the animals he might use. It was the peak of the summer, and it was a hot and dry summer. He husbanded his shot and powder, and learned to catch by trap whatever could be caught. He learned to eat lizard, to eat insects, as he had seen Shoshone do. He learned to find water by the signs of certain vegetation that he knew required water at its taproots. He practiced how he could lure birds of prey by pretending to be a corpse. In these ways, he became adept at survival despite great hardships and learned to accept the circumstance which life had given him. In this manner, emulating the Shoshone whom he was looking for all the while, he survived. But for his worthy imitation, he did not find any sign of their presence, nor any sign of any human presence, nor any sign of any creatures who take a mother's milk, except their skeletal remains in empty, dusty wallows. When he therefore heard the horses of some Indian that he could not see, who must be opposite the low ridge against which he hiked in this maze, he was ambivalent. He hoped to see Shoshone, but feared it was the Blackfoot. He did not show himself, but in this treeless plain there would be no place to hide. He determined then to sit down. The Indians on horseback saw him sitting as they approached from two sides. They approached him without haste or anxiety, though he had a gun. He chose not to use it. There were too many to fend. They were Blackfoot. He stood as they gathered around him without dismounting, and they conversed. He did not understand their words. Several dismounted, and while one held the horses and calmed them by stroking them, the others advanced upon him, took his gun, and roughly removed his clothing. Now having him completely naked, the Blackfoot were amazed to see upon his pale torso, groin, buttocks, and thighs that he was fully and utterly tattooed. Over all these portions of skin hidden from the sun, tattooed with symbols that were unknown to them, not pictures, nothing recognizable, neither words nor letters of any alphabet, but abstractions, ideograms of a knowledge unknown to them, each intricate elemental pattern and emblem, each emblem a complete idea, completely expressed, and all the emblems in some, perhaps, all of the ideas of mankind contained in a unitary cartouche, seamlessly encircling his body. These tattoos were obtained during his long sleep, it is said. Although few men ever knew of them, as he rarely undressed in front of them, nor bathed naked. He hid them, it would seem, from the knowledge of others. What these symbols stood for was not known to any but himself, if indeed he knew what they meant. One, still on horseback, now spoke French to him, and he recognized him by the scar upon his cheek and his attitude, as the one with whom he had parleyed a year ago. He asked him the meaning of the tattoos. The hunter said only that they were not to be explained to one who had not been initiated to them. He nodded. He asked if they had come to him in dreams. The hunter said they had. He told the hunter they were debating among themselves how they should kill him. Some wanted to bind him and take turns with torture. Some thought they should place him at a distance to practice with the gun or other weapons that they had, that the one who killed him should be declared the winner. He asked the hunter, "Do you run fast?" The hunter said, "No." He asked, "Do you tell the truth?" The hunter said, "You may take it from me, my brother. The white man always lies." He was satisfied then and told his comrades what had been said, and then gestured to the hunter and said, "You may go to that rise and then run. Because you are slow, we'll give you that." The rise was a precipice to a canyon. If the scar-faced Blackfoot knew it, it was to suppose that he would not dare to leap into it, and therefore was trapped beside it. But it also meant that should he dare to leap into it, their horses would be no advantage to them, and they should have to pursue him there below on foot. And he was a good runner. He leapt into the open air, and when he landed, he rolled himself over and over until he stood up and felt that he had not injured himself. He ran. A gunshot rang, but the bullet flew away from him so far that he did not see it strike the dirt or hear it pass his ear. And he knew they should be troubled to reload it, and that he should be too far away by then. The canyon declined into another lower plain, into territory that he guessed should slope into a basin he had seen distantly, and there beyond the Shoshone said, a land of demons and hell. The open ground was rocky, but also scattered with prickly pear, and he ran without regard for where his foot might fall. He pierced his feet with thorns of this cactus. They embedded, they shredded his feet. His feet bled, but his pain anesthetized his pain, and only new wounds were felt. The Blackfoot were angry with the scar-faced one who had let him escape, and sent him and his cousins after him, each leaping into the canyon. One of these came up lame and immediately ceased the pursuit. But three others chased, including his nemesis, carrying spears. Pheidippides, I remember this. Pheidippides, run. I remember this. Ran 150 miles across 2 days to beg the Spartans, to beg them come to join the Greeks, to fight the battle, to fight invading Persians. Then later, he ran for 26 miles, from battlefield to Athens, through mountains like this, to tell the victory, defeated Persians. Ninicacamon, we have won. And then, he died. The hunter ran all afternoon. He looked behind himself only twice. Once he looked when he stopped for water. He saw there were two chasing him, carrying spears. He ran now until the sun began to set, his shadow recoiling to the left of him. The second time he looked back, dusk loomed, and he wanted to stop because his lungs had hemorrhaged, blood flowing from his mouth. He saw there was only one now chasing him, carrying a spear. It was the scar-faced Blackfoot. He saw that he was closer than before. He knew he was losing the race. And so, at an open spot, he stopped at last and turned himself about to face his enemy, spreading his arms out wide, and the Indian, who was so startled by the sight of him, the blood from his mouth overflowing his chin, the blood bathing his chest to his groin, crimson as he stood in the red glare of a dying sun, that the Indian stumbled when he tried to pull himself short, caught his spear point on the ground before the hunter, broke it in two, and stumbling fell, the broken end of his spear embedded in the ground, stabbed him in his abdomen where he fell and pierced his liver. He did not die immediately. The hunter, kneeling in exhaustion, reached out as he caught his breath to shove the Indian off his impaling broken spear and helped him draw it out. Blood poured from the wound when it was removed. The Indian clutched the wound with his hands, and his blood seeped into his fingers. The hunter pressed his hand there, also to help him compress it, to help him stop his bleeding. But both saw it was no use. Both looked into each other's eyes. "Je regrette," the hunter said. The Blackfoot died. Who does not know that murder is wrong does not know the imminence of his own death. There is no man that is not like me, alive and wanting to be. Never again will I look into the eyes of another man and not know what he thinks, for I know we are the same. I do not regret that he did not kill me, but still I wish he had not died. When he did, a portion of my soul passed with his soul.